So as Anne said, I've started last week talking about exploring the path of practice through some of the Buddha's own words. And last week I talked about a teaching that encourages us to really come and explore the practice for ourselves. Come and see. Pay attention for ourselves in the present moment to see what we can understand. And that is the path of our practice, not just believing, not just listening, but taking what we learn and applying it in our lives. And tonight, I'd like to talk about some of the core teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha often said that he taught just suffering and the end of suffering. That was the main message that he wanted to convey. And the main way that he talked about those was through the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And in the spirit of what I talked about last week, these are not simply truths put out there that are meant to be believed or just as statements, but they are actually practices. And the Buddha actually suggested an action to go with each of these four truths. He said that the truth of suffering should be understood. The truth of the cause of suffering should be abandoned. The truth of the cessation of suffering should be realized. And the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering should be cultivated. So tonight, I'd like to explore primarily the second and third noble truths and what the Buddha had to say in some depth about these, particularly the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. So the statement of the second noble truth, that suffering has a cause, that part is actually important in and of its own right because it states that it's not simply a random event in our lives, that there's some kind of causal connection or causal action that's going on that causes suffering. And he stated that the primary cause of our suffering is this, the notion of, in Pali it's called tanha, and that word is often translated as craving. In the Pali, the word literally means thirst, which I think gives some idea about the kind of biological or urgency that comes with this feeling of craving. Because when we're thirsty, the body has an urgency towards finding water. So the craving that we're talking about here has a kind of a impulsion behind it. It's got an urgency to fix something or solve something. Not all, and sometimes the term tanha is translated as desire. And I think that's it can be a problematic translation because there's also a term in Pali, chanda, which is also translated as desire, and that means the desire or the wholesome intention for practice. So desire itself, in and of itself, is not necessarily an unwholesome or unskillful thing. It's this desire or this craving that's accompanied by this need to change, this need to modify, this urgency to fix. That's how I kind of look at this craving that causes suffering. So when we think of wanting in terms of suffering, we often think of wanting something, or when we think of the term of wanting itself, we often think of wanting something to get. But the term for the term tanha refers not only to things we want to have, but things we also want to get rid of. That movement of wanting to pull things to us or wanting to push things away, it's both tanha. It's both that craving. Basically, it's that craving to change something, the craving to fix something, this feeling something is not right, it needs to change, whether it's something we like or something we don't like. And this movement of wanting to pull things to us or wanting to push things away from us is primarily rooted in a very simple action, a very simple experience and action of mind. When we experience things, when any experience contacts our sense bases, our senses, it will have some flavor to it, a flavor of whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And based on that very simple feeling tone, if it's pleasant, we tend to like it and we want it. We want more of it. And if it's unpleasant, we tend to not like it and we want to push it away. And this is a very core place where a lot of our suffering springs from. This movement from this pleasant or unpleasant to liking and wanting and wanting to keep something that's pleasant, wanting to construct our lives to be, this is good right now, I want to keep this. Or to get rid of something that's unpleasant, to push it away. You know, I don't like this, I want to get rid of it. I want to fix this situation. So these movements of desire and aversion are rooted in this very simple experience of pleasant and unpleasant, and it's a very natural consequence of being a living being, really. I mean, if you look at an amoeba, you know, as a living being, it goes towards food and it goes away from some kind of noxious environment, you know. So it's really kind of almost hardwired into us to react to this pleasant and unpleasant. It seems so hardwired that it seems like there's nothing we can do about it. But that is simply a misunderstanding, actually, because we can experience things as pleasant or unpleasant and not react to them. It's possible. It's difficult. It's challenging, but it is possible. But back to wanting a little bit. One of the interesting and kind of surprising things about this quality of wanting is that, and I think one of the brilliancies of the Buddha was to point actually to the wanting, to the craving itself. Wanting is another term for tanha. To point to that wanting itself as the cause. It's actually, that's what causes our suffering. We tend to have our attention outwards. You know, if we want something or if we are unhappy about something, say, you know, we think, I'm unhappy because I can't afford a new car, or I'm unhappy because my boss didn't compliment me on that presentation I made today. We are focused outwards on the car or on the wanting of the compliment, you know, the fact that our boss didn't do this thing. And it's harder to actually see that the unhappiness comes from the wanting the car or the wanting the compliment. Let me give a simple example of a chocolate craving. I'm sure many of you have experienced this. So if we crave a piece of chocolate, we have that feeling of, you know, kind of an urge to have the chocolate. And if there's chocolate around and we eat it, there's kind of a feeling of satisfaction of, yes, this is good, and that craving often goes away. I mean, it may take two or three pieces, but it'll probably go away at some point. And we associate the fact that the happiness comes from getting that chocolate, or the feeling of satisfaction comes from getting the chocolate. But actually, part of the satisfaction comes from the fact that we no longer want the chocolate. If we didn't have chocolate to be had, I mean, maybe we're driving through the desert and we have this urge come up, you know, the thought of chocolate comes into our mind and we have this craving for chocolate, but we can't get any. You know, at some point we'll forget about that craving or that urge for chocolate, and the suffering of that urge is gone when that wanting goes. But we don't often notice that possibility. What we mostly key into is the fact that if I want something and I get it, I'm satisfied, I'm happy. And we start to think that is the way to happiness. satisfying our desires, that's how we can be happy. So we live our lives that way, actually, and we've trained ourselves. That's how we can be happy. So over and over again, we are on this chain of, you know, we have some kind of a desire or movement of mind to have something or want something, and if we get it, then we have this moment of satisfaction, and then maybe there's a new wanting. And we end up in this cycle of, you know, a new wanting, a new having, a new moment of satisfaction, and then another, well, it's not so good anymore, I need something else. And we just kind of chain along in this cycle of wanting and desire, and it just kind of pulls us through. So the Buddha described this cycle of the creation of the wanting and the ultimately the suffering that comes out of that, because we cannot keep things. I mean, if we want a situation to be a certain way, and we think we've arranged it to be a certain way, there's no possible way we can hold it there. There's just, you know, this flow of impermanence that permeates all experience. Everything changes, and there's no way to keep anything where it is. So if we're attached to something being a particular way, it will change, and we will suffer from that. And he described this whole chain in a very detailed set of causal conditions. When I said that the second noble truth is that suffering has a cause, basically, the Buddha laid out this causal chain of conditions in a very detailed teaching called the chain of dependent origination or dependent co-arising. And I'd like to talk about that this evening. Now, some of you may know some of this teaching, and it's a fairly dense teaching. And I will read to you one of the places, one of the many places the Buddha talks about this. This is from the Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. So it's a whole sutta about this topic. But in the middle of it, he describes this teaching on dependent conditions. And I'll just read this, and then I'll go through it in some more detail. So I say to you thus, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. So that part's simply a statement of that things have a causal connection. And now he goes on to lay out the chain of causal conditions that lead us into suffering. That is, with ignorance as condition, formations come to be. With formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. With consciousness as condition, materiality, mentality comes to be. With materiality, mentality as condition, the sixfold sense base comes to be. With the sixfold sense base as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, being. With being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So that teaching is fairly dense. And I will try to unpack it here a little bit. And I want to just say to you that that what I'm going to be talking about, I like to provide the practical aspects of things. So I'm going to be talking partly about how I have found this useful in my own experience. So I'm going to go through the whole thing, but I'm also going to point out what I find useful about this. So I'd like to just say a few things about this teaching. First of all, it's a cyclic chain, so that with the whole mass of suffering, it basically goes back to the beginning, which is ignorance, and it chains back again. So basically, that suffering experience without wisdom leads us into more ignorance, which is how a lot of our habits and conditions come to be. You know, when we do something, we find it maybe helpful, and we just end up kind of in this almost repetitive pattern without a lot of thought about it. So this chain that he talks about is a cycle. It's cyclic. It's also causative in nature. Each piece leads to the next in a kind of a dependent pattern. Now, I will just mention briefly here that this is not a fixed pattern. It does not mean that we are stuck in this chain. There are ways that we can kind of cut into this chain and move away from this pattern. And I'll talk about that some more later on. So the classical teachings on this, I mean, this is a fairly complex teaching. And at one point, the Buddha's main attendant, Ananda, went up to him and said, in kind of a, you know, enthusiastic way, "Oh, Sayadaw, or teacher, you know, I really understand this dependent origination. It's as clear to me as it could be. It is so clear." And the Buddha, knowing that Ananda was not yet fully awakened, said to Ananda, "Don't say that, Ananda. This teaching is very deep and very profound, and one who understands this fully understands everything I have to say." So basically, one who understands this teaching is fully liberated. Now, I can't claim to be there, so I'll say that right now. But I do have a sense of understanding some pieces of it, and the pieces that I find useful and valuable. They're huge pieces of this teaching that are incredibly powerful in terms of helping us to cut through the patterns that cause our suffering. So it's a fairly complex teaching, and you know, the historical or classical way of teaching this from the time of the Buddha had some pedagogical ways to teach this. And the main pedagogical tool that they used to teach this particular chain of dependent origination was to break the chain up into three lives, and saying the things that happen in this part of the chain in a past life condition what happens here in this part of the chain in the present life, which then in turn conditions what happens in the last part of the chain in a future life. And I think, you know, if I think about the mindset of the Indian, you know, the Indian mindset, 100, 200 years after the Buddha, when these teachings were being codified, most of the people that they were talking to had no question about this idea of other lives, rebirth. It's the way they think. It's the way they function. So it wasn't a stretch for them to have this kind of teaching. In fact, it was probably helpful for them to think about it in this way. So there's another way to look at this teaching that a teacher, a great Thai teacher from the last century, Ajahn Buddhadasa, looked at the suttas and studied this teaching and said, it's not necessary to think of this as broken over multiple lives. This is happening moment by moment in our experience. This entire set of causes and conditions is happening moment by moment for us. So this is something we can see right here in this very life. If we look into our direct experience, we can see this operating for us and cut that chain and free ourselves from suffering. So there's a couple of links in particular where the terminology is problematic. For instance, there's the link between becoming and birth. And the term birth, you know, we tend to think of being born into a womb, you know, that we're born from a mother. And that might tend towards an easy breaking. That is a point where they break between lives, between those two links. But what Ajahn Buddhadasa said is that term birth can refer to, and I've seen also in the suttas, the term, it says that it does also refer to this birth into a self or an identity. So we can also think of it that way, that a birth doesn't have to be a physical birth, but it could be simply a coalescing around, this is me, this is who I am, I'm like this, this is mine. So that kind of a birth. So I particularly resonate with this teaching that Buddhadasa gives, that we can see this in our moment-to-moment experience. Because I don't have any evidence in my own experience for past lives, it's hard for me to really feel that for me is a relevant way to approach this teaching. But the way that Buddhadasa teaches it is extremely relevant. And I have seen in my own experience how these links of the chain trigger one another in very precise and detailed fashion. So that's the way I'm going to approach this talk tonight, talking about these links of the chain. I'm also going to start in kind of an unconventional way, because the first link of the chain goes from ignorance to formations. But the first three or four links of the chain are some of the most complicated to really grasp and understand. So I'm going to start in the middle, where it's a little bit easier to understand it. So I'm going to start from the link that's called mentality-materiality, which is basically simply our psychophysical being, the mind and the body. Mentality, mind, materiality, body. So the fact that we have a mind and a body means that we come into contact with experience. Or actually, because we have a mind and a body, we have these sense bases that allow us to come into contact with experience. So the mentality materiality conditions the six sense bases. That's the next link of the chain. So we have these six sense bases, and in Buddhist psychology, the six sense bases are the five ones that we're familiar with: seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, plus the sense door of the mind. So the mind also contacts experience. It's not a woo-woo kind of thing. It's just a simple, we have a mind and it experiences thoughts, it experiences emotions, and so it's similar to an eye, which experiences sights, just a different kind of object. So because we have a mind and a body, we have these sense bases. And with these sense bases, we now experience the contact with the world. We have the eye, we see a sight, and there's contact of the eye with the sight. That's the next link. So because we have these sense bases, we have contact with experience. That contact with experience comes with a flavor, as I was talking about before. The contact actually has two pieces to it, but the chain of dependent origination focuses on this feeling piece. But with that contact, we get a perception of something that we've contacted. So a sight, a color, a form. And we also have a feeling tone associated with it. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And those two things kind of arise at the same time. The knowing and the perceiving of an object and the fact that it's got a feeling tone, they all arise right at the same time. And the Buddha indicated that this feeling tone, especially when it's not noticed, that's what gets us into this cycle. So we have this feeling tone, something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So for instance, the sight of a rose is typically pleasant. The sight of a decomposing corpse is typically unpleasant. So we just have this feeling tone that's associated with it. We see a rose, it's pleasant. Because of that feeling tone, so we've gone through mind and body, sense, six sense bases, contact, feeling tone. The next one is craving, tanha. So because, based on that feeling tone, we tend to want or not want. If it's pleasant, we like it, we want it. If it's unpleasant, we don't like it, we want to push it away. And from here, things move kind of quickly. So we have that craving, and we want that thing. We have that craving, and we want that thing, and we kind of reach out and grab it. This is the next phase. It's very closely connected to craving, and it's called clinging. So it's the... it was a great description of this that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses, that if you think of a thief in a house and he's looking around for things that he wants and he spies something that he likes, that spying is that, that liking. That's the feeling tone. The act of reaching for the thing is the craving. When he's actually grabbed onto it, that's the clinging. So these things happen really fast. They're not slow, but they're just, one after the other. So they're kind of hard to distinguish, but there are these distinct phases of this process. Once we've clung onto something, we tend to identify with it. We tend to think, oh, it's mine, or I'm like this. This is becoming. This is this identification, basically, the beginning of this identification piece. So this becoming, this identification can be, really subtle. I mean, it can be really obvious, like, this is my glass, nobody better touch it. Or it can be more subtle, like, I'm the kind of person that likes to walk in the woods. So it's just a sense of identity. We're very familiar with these states. We're so familiar with them almost that we don't really notice that it's a constructed state. It's just this, coalescing of thoughts, essentially, around something that says, this is mine, this is who I am. We form an identity. And from this point on in the chain, the Buddha says, suffering is inevitable. Once we've identified with something and said, this is me, or this is mine, we are bound to suffer. Probably from, just simply, maybe from the inevitable fact of impermanence. If this is my glass, at some point I may break it or lose it, or somebody will misplace it, and if I'm really attached to it, really identified with it, I may suffer over that. I grieve the loss of the glass. Or perhaps we have an identity around, I'm the kind of person who is like this. I'm the kind of person who remembers their lines in a play. Or I'm the kind of person who doesn't mess up. I do things well. And if we're confronted with evidence to the contrary, we suffer. So I'd like to take you through an example. This example I just mentioned, actually. I'm the kind of person who remembers lines in the play. This was an experience I had at one point some number of years ago. I was in a play, and I, came to this place where I just couldn't remember my next line. And I tried fudging, making up various lines to kind of key into the other people in the play that I didn't know what I should be saying. So somebody please step in and help me here. And nobody did, And at some point I just lost the momentum of coming up with things to say. And there was just this huge, glaring silence. And people, it's like the wall of the stage was broken. And, looking out, there were people looking up at me. So, what are you going to do now? It was really, really embarrassing, really horrible, really unpleasant feeling. So that's not actually the piece I want to talk about, because this was long before I started my true, my deep meditation practice. But on one retreat, a three-month retreat, this particular memory came up over and over and over and over again. And I relived that embarrassment many times. And after a while, I got really familiar with the pattern. You know, the memory appeared in the mind. You know, just an image of being there on stage with people looking up at me. And this was unpleasant. This memory was unpleasant. And there's an identity around that of, this is not me. You know, this is not who I am. You know, a kind of rejection of that scenario and a feeling of like failure, embarrassment that results from this. So one of the key pieces I want to point out to you here that I noticed in this experience was that after seeing this many, many, many times, I finally began to get the aha that this is happening right now. This embarrassment is being created right now. The memory appears and it's all being constructed right now. It's not like the embarrassment is sitting there underneath deep inside somewhere waiting to attack me. It's actually being constructed because I was reacting in the moment to an unpleasant experience, the memory of being on stage with people looking up at me. So that piece was huge to see. You know, it's just to see, oh, you know, suffering is actually created in the moment. Now, the conditions for that suffering were created in the past. I mean, some of the causal conditions, the fact that I had had that experience of being on stage and forgetting my lines, that had happened in the past. And that was a cause for the memory to arise. But the reactivity to the unpleasantness of the memory was happening right then and there in the present moment. And I began to see if I could just be there with unpleasant. Oh, this is an unpleasant memory, an unpleasant image. You know, eventually I began to see, oh, it doesn't actually have to lead to that whole horrible conglomeration of embarrassment and feelings of failure. It just doesn't have to happen. If I can see in the moment, this is an unpleasant experience. So this is one of the key pieces I want to talk about in terms of the practicality of this teaching, is to, you know, really bringing our attention into our experiencing, particularly noticing the feeling tone of experience, is extremely powerful in helping us to cut this chain of this cycle towards suffering. If we can notice these moments of unpleasantness, moments of pleasantness, and just know, oh, this is pleasant, we don't actually have to grab onto it and say, oh, this is me, this is who I am now. Or we don't have to reject it and say, I don't want this. It can simply be a pleasant experience or an unpleasant experience. So that gives you a little bit of the flavor for this chain of dependent origination. And now I'd like to go back and review those links that I said were some of the more challenging ones, starting from ignorance and moving through formations to consciousness. So, as I pointed out earlier, this is a cyclic chain. So it's worthwhile noticing that suffering is what conditions ignorance. And in fact, the Buddha talked about this. Here's one thing he said about the result of suffering. And what is the result of suffering? There are some cases in which a person overcome with pain, his mind exhausted, grieves, mourns, laments, beats his breast, and becomes bewildered. Or one overcome with pain, his mind exhausted, comes to search outside. Who knows a way or two to stop this pain? I tell you, monks, that suffering results either in bewilderment or search. So this bewilderment piece is really the ignorance, the confusion that happens. So the suffering often leads to this sense of, why me? You know, woe is me. And this is related to what the Buddha called ignorance. So the Buddha's definition of ignorance, his actual definition of ignorance, is not understanding the Four Noble Truths, what I started out with this evening. He says, and what is ignorance? Not knowing about suffering, not knowing about the origin of suffering, not knowing about the cessation of suffering, not knowing about the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance. So ignorance means that we don't understand suffering. We don't understand its cause. We don't understand that it has a way that we can move away from it, a path leading away from it. If suffering is met with wisdom, with mindfulness, it tends to lead us in another direction. It won't lead us back into this cycle, this chain. So if we bring attention to those places that we suffer, if we actually turn our attention to what is it like to be in this situation, as opposed to trying to fix the environment, but turning our attention back and saying, what is it like to be a human being that suffers? This is the way out of the suffering leading to ignorance. Bringing wisdom and mindfulness to the experience of suffering. And I'll talk more about this in a moment. So back to this chain. So ignorance leads, suffering leads to ignorance. And the next link, the next two links actually are some of the more challenging ones. And they are, so with ignorance as condition, mental formations come to be. With mental formations as condition, consciousness comes to be. With consciousness as condition, the psychophysical being, mind and body, comes to be. So with ignorance as condition, mental formations come to be. Well, what mental formations are is basically habits and patterns of mind and body that kind of cycle us around in kind of automatic behaviors. So there are these patterns and habits that kind of lead us to do things in the same way we've always done them. Like I was saying before, we have this movement of thinking. You know, we've been trained to think and to believe through our experience that the way to end our suffering is to satisfy our desires. So we have these patterns and habits around that, that each of us, they look a little different for each of us, but basically they're this pattern of trying to figure out how to satisfy our desires. So these habits and patterns are essentially these mental formations. So these habits and patterns, now what this one is really kind of odd to think about. These habits and patterns, the next link in the chain is consciousness. So these habits and patterns, with these habits and patterns, with these mental formations, consciousness comes to be. And this is another place where they tend to break between lives, because they think about, or the traditional teaching is talking about, the habits and patterns of our previous lives form the conditions for the arising of consciousness in this life to be in a certain way. But we can also think about this, well, I won't go just there just yet, but I'll just talk about another kind of broader way to think about this, is to think about the way that our habits and patterns actually condition what we experience. You know, you think about, if you tend to be, if you tend to be an angry person, you may tend to filter your experience so that you notice things that make you angry, and you kind of filter things out, or they don't actually come as obviously into your consciousness. Gil gave a good example of this. The first time I heard a talk on dependent origination, he used an analogy that I found very helpful. And he said, at one point he was searching for a couch. You know, his couch wore out and he needed a new couch. And suddenly, you know, he said, well, okay, I need to go couch shopping. And suddenly he saw couch stores everywhere. You know, it's like suddenly because his you know, mind was attuned to that, it was appearing in his consciousness, whereas before it wasn't. You know, they weren't out of, you know, the picture of these couch stores. So that's the flavor of how these habits and patterns can condition consciousness. Does that make sense? So another way we can look at this is on a moment-to-moment level that, and this is harder to see, but it is possible to see this in deep states of meditation or in very quiet states of meditation, where we actually start to see consciousness coming to be on a moment-to-moment basis. So that we see a sight and we notice, oh, there's a consciousness of that seeing. And then there's a sound, and there's consciousness of that sound. And we notice that those consciousnesses are not permanent. That the actual seeing the sight, that disappears when another sight comes. So we start to notice actually that the consciousness itself comes and goes. Now again, this is one of those areas where I'll go back to my talk of last week where it's come and see. This is not something that you can really take in as, you know, something somebody tells you. It just sounds so ridiculous in some ways. But it's possible looking moment to moment, we can start to see this. We can even start to see it just if we look at who we think we are. You know, if we look at who am I right now? Who do I think I am right now? You know, there's a sense of that. And if, you know, half an hour later we check in, who am I right now? We might start to notice some differences. You know, that there's not necessarily a continuity in what we call ourselves. So that consciousness of an identity changes. So this is a place where we really need to explore for ourselves. So I'll just encourage you in that direction. It's possible to witness this kind of thing in our own experience. So from consciousness, with consciousness as condition, mind and body comes to be. Now this one is also kind of challenging, you know, to think about. But again, you know, if we thought about if this body was here without consciousness, you know, basically, it wouldn't be functional. You know, it would just be like meat. So the consciousness kind of brings the whole psychophysical being into play. Another piece of this, though, I'd like to point out is that the Buddha, in many places, talked about these two, the consciousness and the psychophysical being, as being really tightly connected. He said that, yes, well, consciousness does condition the mind and body. But the mind and body conditions consciousness, too. We can't really separate them. They come together. So that's where we end up back with the place that I started the whole chain, back to the mind and body, where we have contact with experience through our sense bases, and there's pleasant and unpleasant. So that's the basics of this chain of dependent origination. Ignorance is what starts the chain, basically. Now, the Buddha noticed in this that this chain of events, how it's linked together, and that one causes the next, that it's this, you know, kind of almost lockstep chain of events. But it's not so hopeless as all of that. He did notice that this has some weak links in it. And there's two key ones to pay attention to. And these are the places where we can bring our attention and really move away from the patterns and habits that tend to lead us into suffering over and over again. So one of those weak links is the link between suffering and ignorance. As I mentioned before, the Buddha said suffering either leads to bewilderment or confusion, or it leads to search. If we bring wisdom to our suffering, we can move out of that path to ignorance to a whole different chain of events. There's a whole different chain of causes and conditions the Buddha described from suffering that leads us to freedom. This is called the chain of transcendent dependent origination. And it's a set of 12 links that are links like, you know, suffering leads to faith, which leads to gladness, which leads to rapture, tranquility, happiness, knowing and understanding things as they are, which leads us on to letting go of suffering to liberation. So that's one of the places where the Buddha said we could cut this set of causes and conditions. The other key link, you may have a little taste of this from what I've said before, the other key link where we can short-circuit this cycle is between feeling and craving. And there's a lot of teachings about how we can be mindful of feeling in the Buddha's teaching. And he says over and over again, you know, this is basically the key. This is the link. This is the one that will allow us to be free. If we can witness the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral without the subsequent reactivity in our minds about it, we won't suffer over the fact that things are not the way we want them to be. So I won't go into this into too much detail. I gave a whole talk on it at one point. So there's a lot that can be said about practicing with mindfulness of feeling. It's a really beautiful practice. But I want to really just encourage you to notice it in your experience. I mean, a simple example like going to the dentist, you know, it's a typically unpleasant experience. And often what happens is that from that unpleasant experience, we construct a whole bunch of things about how much we hate being at the dentist and fears about dental treatment and how much it's going to cause us pain. It cascades, and it actually makes the whole situation even more unpleasant because all these fears are unpleasant themselves. So we've piled unpleasant experience on top of unpleasant experience instead of simply resting with the initial unpleasant experience of sitting there with my mouth open and this guy working in my mouth. So we can actually cut into and short circuit this path towards reactivity, which is where all these habits and patterns get born, by just being with the noticing mind with mindfulness, this feeling tone. There's another sutta that I really love that really kind of points to this feeling as being a key link. In this sutta, it kind of starts with the same pattern as the dependent origination, but then once it hits feeling, it goes off in another direction. And I'll read this to you also. This is a really short one. It's kind of poetic. I really like the way this comes about. All things are rooted in desire. They come to actual existence through attention, originate from contact, and converge on feelings. The foremost of all things is concentration. All things are mastered by mindfulness. Their peak is wisdom, their essence liberation. All things merge in the deathless, and Nibbana is their culmination. So there's a couple of key points about this sutta that I want to point out. It's not a causal list like the chain of dependent origination, but this ordering that he gives you a sense that there is a flow from one to the other. So the first part, all things are born of, you know, rooted in attention. The root of all things is desire. They're born of attention, originate with contact, converge on feeling. That part of the of that sutta maps very closely onto the part of the dependent origination chain from mentality and materiality through contact, through feeling. And then the next links of the chain of this sutta talk about mindfulness and concentration. Bringing mindfulness and concentration together to attend to the feeling tone of experience, is what leads us out away from the reactivity. So mindfulness and concentration really work together. You know, the concentration has us staying with our experience moment to moment. And that piece is crucial, because if we waver from the experience of paying attention to the pleasant or unpleasant, we're likely to just kind of automatically slip back into our habits and patterns. So the concentration to stay present for this is unpleasant, just staying present for it. That is the concentration piece. The mindfulness piece lets us know when we've kind of slipped away from it. So the two have to come together. And this is what we practice in our meditation, moment to moment. We practice coming back to the breath, just over and over again, concentration and mindfulness together. The other key point that I want to point out about this sutta is that it refers to all things. It says, all things have liberation as their essence. All things merge in the deathless, which is another term for liberation, basically. All things culminate in nibbana, or freedom. This is all things. All possible experience you can think of has this quality that it can lead us to freedom. It doesn't matter what experience we bring our concentration and mindfulness to. It can be the most mundane thing, touching a doorknob, brushing our teeth, paying attention to the in and out breathing. It can be the most simple, most mundane thing. And it can lead us to freedom if we notice with mindfulness and wisdom what is actually happening in the moment, how we contact with pleasant and unpleasant, how we tend to react to it. Can we stay present in this moment? So come and see for yourself about this teaching. See if you can bring your attention to this pleasant and unpleasant. Bring your attention to the suffering. And what do you observe? What do you notice? This is what leads us to the end of suffering. So those are my thoughts on dependent origination. And there's a few minutes left. I talked quite a bit longer than I normally do, but it's a big topic, so there's about 5 minutes if anybody has any comments or questions.
Would an enlightened being experience emotional pain? I mean, they might experience physical pain if they stub their toe, but what about emotional pain?
The Buddha said that an enlightened being experiences pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, but will not end up in the weeping and moaning and beating their breast and, you know, grieving, essentially. Now, there's a set of what can be called emotions that are kind of the what's left in our being when we let go of all of our habits of mind, basically. And these are mind states like mindfulness, equanimity, loving kindness, compassion. So those emotions, they are essentially emotions, that's the flavor of what an enlightened being is said to experience. They would not experience what we would call the afflictive emotions, you know, the anger, the frustration, hostility, rage. They would not experience those. They would experience the deep sort of, you know, compassion is a kind of a, you know, a deep, you know, it's a form of suffering in a sense, but it's a, you know, it's an acceptance of the suffering. It's a holding of the suffering. That's the closest they would come, I think, to what might be called a negative emotion, but compassion doesn't actually have a negative feeling. It has a feeling of a sense of, you know, wanting to help or wanting to.
I mean, like, for example, what if an enlightened being was going through a messy divorce? You know, something like that. You know, I mean, it's possible that someone could be enlightened but just have to have a divorce, or, you know, would they experience emotional pain?
Well, you know, according to the teachings, according to the Buddhist teachings, they would experience compassion for the suffering of the others in the situation. but not the the pain and grief of, I'm so angry at you because you're doing these things to me. But that level of enlightenment is very refined. You know, there are four stages of enlightenment, and it's not until the third stage that you're completely free of those kinds of emotions, you know, the afflictive emotions. They still are coming up very far along in this process of freeing ourselves. Oops.
I wish I could remember the word you were using, because when you were first talking about dependent co-arising and you were talking about how the Indians might view it in terms of a past life, a current life, and a future life, and then you were talking about how it might also be framed in terms of life experiences. And I was wondering if you could just give an example of ways that your life experiences might frame the way you would view a different way of viewing this alternative to past, future, and current lives.
I don't quite understand your question.
I wish I had written down the word you used. I didn't.
So, yeah, I'm not sure. Are you talking about the time when I was talking about the mental formations conditioning consciousness, or are you talking about just the whole chain of dependent origination being considered as a moment-to-moment phenomenon, as opposed to something happening over lives?
I don't know, and I didn't write down anything much more at that point either. It was right when you were talking about the five senses and then right before you moved on. But it was an alternative to viewing it.
Well, I did talk about birth. I talked about birth being the birth of a self, a sense of self. Is that what you're referring to?
Right before that, yes.
Right before that. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So it is 9:00, so I'm sorry I can't help you. Maybe we could talk after and you could jar my memory. So thank you for your attention, and I hope to see you next week.